It's February 2nd, 1974, 6 a.m. In Seattle, Washington, a freezing wind howls through the city. The sidewalks are icy and the rooftops covered in sprinklings of snow. The sun hasn't yet risen, and the snow shows no signs of melting. Inside a modest house on one of the city's residential streets, not far from the Washington University campus, 24-year-old Kathleen McChesney is already awake and starting her day. McChesney is a Seattle police officer, one of the only female deputies in the city. She's renowned for her ability to find and solve crimes and is quickly making a name for herself as a talented detective. But this morning, McChesney isn't thinking about work. It's Saturday and there's only one thing on her mind. Skiing. The snowfall's been heavy this week, and McChesney cannot wait to get out to the mountains. There's a popular ski resort just a few minutes away from here. So McChesney rushes down to her kitchen, switches on the radio, and turns it to the Northwest Ski Reports channel. One of the reporters, 22-year-old Linda Ann Healy, a student at Washington University, can always be relied upon to give good weather updates. McChesney stares longingly at her skis in the corner as she waits to hear Healy's forecast. However, when the ski report starts, it's not Healy's voice coming across the airwaves. Instead, it's a man, someone McChesney doesn't recognize. McChesney turns the volume up and presses her ear to the radio. The man's voice announces that, unfortunately, Healy isn't at work today, so there'll be no weather report. McChesney sighs in disappointment and turns the radio off. But as she does so, she feels a pang of worry. McChesney has woken up to Linda Ann Healy's cheery voice most mornings for the past year. Come rain, shine, or heavy snowfall, Healy has been on air. So why isn't she now? For any other listener, her absence probably wouldn't raise much concern. But for McChesney, a rising detective, it's likely that alarm bells start to ring. McChesney perhaps wonders what's happened to Healy that's forced her to miss a day of work. Could it be something as innocent as snowfall, sickness, or a university final? Or is there a more sinister reason? Maybe it's not just something that's kept Healy from work this morning, but someone. Tragically, Kathleen McChesney was right to worry. In the days that follow the absent ski forecaster, Linda Ann Healy is reported missing. When police search the house she shares with four other girls, they find a horrifying sight. Healy's bed, although neatly made, is stained with blood. Her nightdress hangs in the closet, and that too is streaked with her blood. It's obvious to police that Healy's been attacked and abducted by a violent individual. But police have no idea where she is, what sort of condition she's in now, or who took her. Nor do they realize that the abduction of Linda Ann Healy is not an isolated incident. Over the next 4 years, the person who attacked Healy will strike again multiple times, sparking an epidemic of fear throughout all of America. But who is this person, abducting and possibly killing young girls? And will police ever catch them? At the moment of death, people often have an overwhelming need to get their biggest secret off their chest. From murder, fake identities, illicit affairs, and even government cover-ups, this show dives deep into the world's most explosive deathbed confessions. This is the story of America's most deadly serial killer and the fear he instilled across the nation. It's about the mysterious disappearances of countless young girls and women, a police force who were constantly one step behind, a murderer hiding in plain sight, and his deathbed confession, which confirmed his status as the most notorious killer the world has ever known. I'm Estefania Hakeman, and this is Deathbed Confessions.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Hi, I'm Blair.
Wanna hear something scary?
Join me as I read the creepiest urban legends, folk tales, and ghost stories that I learn on my travels around the world and that we receive from listeners like you. But only if you think you can handle it. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, sweet screams.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. Search To Die For in your podcast app to follow the show.
Following the disappearance of Linda Ann Healy in February 1974, Washington State is plunged into fear. Police officers, including Kathleen McChesney, investigate the case of Healy but come up empty-handed. It seems as though, on the night she vanished, Healy had a perfectly normal evening. She ate dinner with friends, went to bed at her usual time, and showed every intention of waking up to her 5:30 a.m. alarm to walk to work at the radio station. This proves to police that someone unknown to Healy broke into her room and took her against her will, meaning there's an attacker and possible killer on the loose. All too soon, these fears are confirmed. Another girl vanishes in Washington. 5 weeks after Healy went missing, a 19-year-old student from Evergreen College in Olympia disappears on her way out to meet friends. The girl was going to a concert on campus, but never made it that far. Is it possible that she's been taken by the same person that snatched Healy? Police believe so and start looking for links between the two girls, if they knew the same people or perhaps frequented the same places. But just like last time, before they can make any headway on the case, tragedy strikes again, and again, and again. A female university student disappears in April, followed by another young woman in May, and two more in June. Each of the girls vanished without a trace. Police are left baffled, and the public is terrified. No one has any idea when or where the attacker will strike next, or who will be their latest victim. Due to the volume of attacks, police are able to compile some useful information about them. And before long, a pattern starts to emerge. Investigators notice that the girls are all young, between the ages of 18 to 22 years old. All of them attend universities in Washington State and were taken from their college campuses. Strangely, every girl who's disappeared so far has long dark hair parted in the middle. What's more, police have also begun to build a picture of the possible attacker. On the night of one of the June disappearances, a group of students from the University of Washington reported seeing a young man hanging around their sorority house. It was dark, so they couldn't make out many of his features. But what they do recall is that he was tall and had his leg in a cast. He was limping between the sorority house and a VW Beetle, which was parked nearby. Unfortunately, though, this testimony isn't particularly helpful. At a co-ed university such as Washington, there are countless tall young men. It's also possible that a number of them wear casts on their legs. And of course, VW Beetles are one of the most popular cars at this time, so this detail hardly helps narrow the search. For now, police simply have to keep on looking in the hope that a more damning clue will arise. In the meantime, the only advice they can give is for girls to walk around campus in groups of two or more and never leave their houses after dark. But it's a naive belief that the attacker will only strike once the sun set. With a case like this, no one's safe at any time, not even in broad daylight. It's July 14th, 1974. Lake Sammamish Park, Washington State. It's a beautiful summer's day. The sun is shining, there's not a cloud in the sky, and a warm, gentle breeze whistles through the trees. The park is crowded with people this afternoon, around 40,000 individuals. Everyone's enjoyed a long day of sunbathing, playing sports, picnicking with friends, and watching an array of circus performances. Despite the horrors that have haunted Washington these past 5 months, today has been a chance to kick back and relax, to look forward to the summer ahead. However, as the sun starts to dip below the trees and a cool breeze picks up, the atmosphere at Lake Sammamish Park changes. In the early evening, a squad of police cars speed into the park, their sirens flash in the setting sun blaring noisily. Officers scramble out of the cars and rush over to a group of bikers. They've received reports that the bikers have been behaving dangerously and causing trouble. However, the biker incident is not the only report from Lake Sammamish Park that officers will receive. Just hours later, they hear chilling news which fills them with horror. 2 girls have disappeared. As the sun sets on Lake Sammamish Park and nightfall spreads through the town, police learn that 23-year-old Janice Ott and 19-year-old Denise Naslund have gone missing. Early the next day, on July 15th, Washington police take action. They send detectives and dogs to Lake Sammamish Park, hoping that they'll pick up the slightest trace of either girl. Meanwhile, investigators set about gathering as much information as possible. They need to be sure the 2 girls didn't simply wander off on their own accord or get lost. After circulating physical descriptions of both girls, investigators speak with a group who claim to have seen Janice Ott in the early afternoon of July 14th. The group explain that they last saw Ott sitting by the lake in the center of the park. As she applied sunscreen to her body, a tall, attractive young man with his arm in a sling approached her, and the 2 struck up a conversation. Not long after that, they saw Ott slip a t-shirt and a pair of shorts over her bikini and follow the stranger. She wasn't seen again. Next, police speak to the boyfriend of Denise Naslund. He explains that while he and his friends were sitting on the eastern part of the park, Naslund went to the restrooms. She bumped into a tall stranger who wore his arm in a sling. Naslund and the stranger spoke for a few minutes, and she, just like Ott, followed him. This didn't take her boyfriend by surprise at first. Naslund often helped people, and he believed she was simply doing someone a favor. But when minutes stretched into hours and Naslund didn't return, her boyfriend realized something was seriously wrong. That's when he called the police. After hearing the separate cases of these 2 girls, Washington police agree that both Ott and Naslund must have been abducted by the same man. But what type of person would take 2 girls in broad daylight in front of thousands of potential witnesses? And where are Ott and Naslund now? After 5 months of disappearances, and with 8 girls now missing, pressure is mounting on the police to find out. Over the next few days, as news about Janice Ott and Denise Naslund spreads, Washington police focus on finding out everything they can about the mysterious tall stranger. Fortunately for them, there were around 40,000 people at the park that day, so there's no shortage of witnesses. Back at the police station, they interview several individuals who claim to have been approached by the man seen with Ott and Naslund. All of these are young women, and they tell a similar story. The man introduced himself to them as Ted and explained that his injured arm prevented him from lifting his sailboat from his car. He asked the girls if they'd walk back to his VW Beetle with him and help carry the boat. A few of the girls refused, preferring to spend time with their friends, so Ted let them be. But several agreed and walked with him as far as his car. When they got there, they saw no sailboat attached to the Beetle. Sensing that something wasn't right, the girls turned on their heels and fled. After hearing this, police have a pretty good idea of what may have happened. It seems likely that Ott and Naslund were taken in by Ted's story of his alleged sailboat and arm injury and wanted to help him out. Tragically for them, by the time they'd realized there was no boat, it was too late. By now, police have learned the kidnapper's name, the story he spun, as well as the car he drove, although they don't yet know his license plate number. In addition to these details, they're also beginning to get a good idea of his appearance. A few of the witnesses agree to sit down with an artist and help create a sketch of the suspect. The artist draws a tall white man, around 6 foot, with dark curly hair and piercing blue eyes. The man is clean-shaven and smartly dressed. After seeing this sketch, it doesn't take police long to link the attacks of Ott and Naslund with the other disappearances in Washington. In the previous cases, witnesses described seeing a tall man with curly hair driving a VW Beetle. He also was injured, although it was a bandaged leg as opposed to an arm in a sling. Police strongly suspect that the kidnapper is faking these injuries in order to lure his victims in. By pretending to have a broken arm or leg, people will feel sympathy towards him and be more inclined to help. Authorities are in no doubt that all 8 abductions are linked and that this mysterious Ted is the man behind each and every one. So they release his picture in Washington newspapers and pin flyers up around the city. Maybe someone somewhere will know who Ted really is. As it turns out, hundreds of people think they do. Throughout July, Washington police are inundated with tips, alleged sightings, theories, and information about Ted. One stands out in particular. A young woman called Liz Klopfer phones police and says that she's worried her boyfriend is behind the abductions. Her boyfriend is a 28-year-old man who matches the physical description. He's also a student at Washington University, where many of the disappearances occurred, and he drives a VW Beetle. But there's more. Klopfer tells police she once found a bag of women's underwear inside his apartment, a bowl filled with stolen house keys, bandages in his jacket pockets, and a knife hidden under the front seat of his car. Worryingly, on the night of one of the disappearances, her boyfriend was out the entire time and didn't return until late the next morning. When asked his name, Klopfer quickly gives it: Ted Bundy. Police are intrigued by this tip. The similarities do seem to be uncanny. They check the system to see if a Ted Bundy comes up with any prior criminal convictions, and that's when they see a match. 2 more people have recently given tips about him in relation to the Ott and Naslund cases. Both of them called police to say they believe 28-year-old Ted Bundy is the man behind the abductions. This is the biggest lead police have had since the first disappearance in February, almost 6 months ago. Excited by this possible breakthrough, they decide to investigate Ted Bundy as their prime suspect. Interestingly, though, when police show Ted Bundy's photograph to 8 witnesses from Lake Sammamish Park, witnesses who claim to have spoken to him, 7 of them deny that it's him. They're certain that this clean-cut, attractive man staring at them from the photograph was not the man in the park. As a result, police have no choice but to drop Bundy as their prime suspect. Liz Klopfer's testimony must simply be a collection of coincidences. Now they're back to square one. They have no suspects and no leads. All they can do is pray that a break in the case will come soon. The date is now September 6th, 1974, 2 months since Janice Ott and Denise Naslund disappeared from Lake Sammamish Park. Thankfully, the abductions seem to have stopped for now, and the people of Washington are beginning to resume their normal lives. Today, as the pale sun starts to rise, a hiker walks through thick woodland and muddy paths in Issaquah, a large town in Washington. His journey takes him up steep hills and alongside an old railroad track. At the top of one particularly lengthy climb, the hiker pauses for breath and takes a look at the view. Miles below him is the sprawling grass of Lake Sammamish Park. But like so many in Washington, this sight only serves to remind him of the awful recent events. So the hiker turns his back on the park and hurries on with his journey. A few minutes later, as he's approaching a grassy trail off Interstate 90, the hiker feels something hard beneath his feet. When he looks down, he has to cover his mouth to stop himself from screaming out in terror. There on the grass in front of him is a woman's partially decomposed body. his heart thumping in his throat, the hiker tears through the woods until he reaches the interstate. Once there, he finds a payphone and calls 911. Within minutes, the woodland is crawling with police and detectives. It's not long until they make another gruesome discovery. Just meters away from the first body, buried in the long grass, they find the remains of a second woman. Like the first, this body is partially decomposed, and coroners estimate both women have been dead for around 2 months. Later that same afternoon, police are horrified to find the remains of a third woman along the Issaquah Trail. These remains are badly decomposed. It's clear that the third body has been here significantly longer than the first two. After carefully examining all three sets of remains, coroners rule that the first body was that of 23-year-old Janice Ott, and the second, 19-year-old Denise Nasland, the girls who went missing from Lake Sammamish Park. As for the third body, it's too damaged to identify. The importance of these findings cannot be overstated. At once, they prove to Washington police that they don't simply have a series of abductions on their hands. They're dealing with murders. And although police don't know it yet, this is just the start of what's to come. As fall freezes to winter and melts away to spring, police recover the remains of more women. Discarded in the undergrowth of Washington's Taylor Mountain Forest, a large, sprawling area of almost 2,000 acres, they find a collection of human remains. Police retrieve the skulls of four young women, as well as their jawbones and other fragments from their bodies. When the remains are taken to the lab to be identified, police sadly announce that they belong to four of the women who disappeared from their college campuses in early 1974. Tragically, one of the skulls belonged to Linda Ann Healy, the 22-year-old weather reporter whose missing persons case started it all. These horrific discoveries prove what many had long suspected, but not wanted to believe. There's a serial killer on the loose, one who goes by the name of Ted. Following the discovery of the women's remains in the Taylor Mountain Forest, the Washington murders become national news. It's during this time, as news of the serial killer spreads throughout the nation, that some disturbing information arises. It turns out that the abductions and killings didn't end with Janice Ott and Denise Nasland in July 1974, as Washington police previously believed. Rather, the attacks moved state. Almost 200 miles south, police from Utah alert Washington authorities to the fact that three young women recently disappeared. In the fall of 1974, the girls vanished without a trace. Utah police hadn't treated the disappearances as suspicious or linked until they heard about Washington's serial killer. Now they're worried that the attacker has started preying on women in their state. And they're not the only ones with this concern. Authorities from Colorado echo these suspicions. They explain that five women from the state went missing in early 1975. It seems that Washington's mysterious killer is on the move, traveling down the west coast of America. Now, police in Washington, Utah, and Colorado start to share information. As it turns out, the killer made a crucial mistake during his stint in Utah. He let one of his victims get away alive. 19-year-old Carol DeRanche, a student at Utah University, was abducted in November 1974. She was shopping at a local mall when a tall, attractive stranger with dark curly hair and blue eyes approached her and said he was a cop called Ted. The man then informed her that her car had been broken into, and she must travel with him to the police station to report the crime. DeRanche admits she was skeptical at first, but when the man flashed his police badge, she believed his story and climbed into his car, a VW Beetle. However, not long into their journey, the man pulled over and started to attack DeRanche. He grabbed a crowbar from under his seat and lifted it above his head. Seconds before the crowbar could come crashing down, DeRanche threw her hands into the air and caught it. Then, she escaped from the car and ran for her life. When DeRanche repeats this testimony to Washington police, she's shown the artist's sketch of Ted that was drawn last year. As soon as she sees the drawing of the curly-haired man, she identifies him as her attacker. Now there's proof that all of the attacks are linked, those in Washington, Utah, and Colorado. Next, police show Durant photographs of several suspects. Instantly, she selects one, absolutely certain that this man was her would-be killer. It's the photo of 28-year-old Ted Bundy. Following these developments, the FBI decides it's time to get involved. By now, 17 girls have been abducted, 8 in Washington, 4 in Utah, and 5 in Colorado. Thanks to the testimony of Carol Durant, the FBI believes Ted Bundy is likely the man behind these abductions and murders. His physical description matches the suspect, he drives the same car, goes by the name of Ted, and was identified by Durant. However, all of the evidence against Bundy is circumstantial. No one has any hard proof that he attacked, abducted, or killed the girls. The bodies they recovered were so badly decomposed that they were unable to find any traces of his DNA. The only case police can directly link Bundy to is the attempted kidnap of Durant, a crime which could see him locked behind bars for up to 20 years. And so, the FBI plans to pull Bundy in on this lesser felony, and then, once they've gathered more evidence, charge him with murder. But first, they need to find him. The date is now August 16th, 1975. 18 months have passed since the disappearances first began in Washington, and another 5 months since police concluded they were the work of a serial killer, most likely a man called Ted Bundy. The investigation has moved from Washington to Salt Lake City, the area where Carol Durant was attacked. Police believe it's possible that Bundy's still living in the town. But although detectives have searched everywhere they can think of, and the FBI have put their best agents on the job, no one's been able to find the slightest trace of Bundy. It's as though he's vanished into thin air. Tonight, two Utah police officers are driving through Salt Lake City on their rounds. The roads are quiet, and dusk is setting over the town, making visibility poor. As the officers come to a stop at a set of red lights, they notice a VW Beetle traveling slowly towards them. The officers think little of it until its driver starts acting strangely. The Beetle's headlights are suddenly shut off, and it speeds up. It roars past the policemen, ignoring the red lights and stop signs. Acting fast, the officers sound their sirens and chase after the car. Flashing constantly for it to pull over, they follow it through the wide streets of Salt Lake City, across interstates and overpasses, until they eventually run out of road. The Beetle crawls to a stop and its driver obediently climbs out. As the two Utah officers walk towards the car, they have no idea what they're about to find. Turning their flashlights on with a click, the officers open the doors of the Beetle and peer inside. As their eyes scan between the seats, they notice an assortment of strange objects. Thrown onto one of the back seats is a black balaclava, and next to that, a pile of trash bags. When the officers climb into the car to take a closer look, they find a crowbar and an ice pick buried in the footwells. Then, hidden beneath the driver's seat, they discover a pair of silver handcuffs. The officer's suspicions are raised at once, and they ask the driver why he's got this assortment of weapons. The driver laughs carelessly and explains that he found the handcuffs in a dumpster and that he uses the balaclava for skiing. He doesn't explain why he has the ice pick or crowbar, though. The officers don't buy his excuses for a second and drive him to the local police station, where they plan to press charges for being in the possession of burglary tools. But once there, under the bright, fluorescent lights of the station, police notice something strange about the man, something that sparks a chilling recognition. The man's hair is dark and curly, his eyes shine a bright blue, and he's tall, almost 6 foot. Police ask the man his name, and when he gives it, it takes the air from their lungs. Ted Bundy. This is it. Finally, after a year and a half of brutal killings and a desperate police search, They found him. Ted Bundy is held at the Salt Lake City Police Station and charged with two crimes. The first is for being in possession of burglary tools. The second is the attempted kidnap of 19-year-old Carol DeRanch. Despite Bundy's pleas of innocence, police have enough evidence to charge him for both crimes. His trial date is set for February 23, 1976. For now, these are the only felonies Bundy will stand trial for. Police have little choice but to pray that they'll also be able to link him to the murder cases. When word spreads that Ted Bundy has been arrested in connection with Carol DeRanch's kidnap, a strange thing happens. Some members of the public begin protesting for his innocence. All throughout Utah, men and women claim that Bundy is not a criminal or a violent man. They don't believe there's any way he tried to harm Carol DeRanch, let alone kill the other 16 women police have linked him to. Bundy is known as an intelligent, well-liked man in the community. He's popular with classmates at the Utah School of Law, is praised by many of his professors, and is even an active member of the Church of Latter-day Saints. In fact, the church is one of Bundy's biggest supporters. Members sign their names on a banner with Bundy's face at the center, promising to fight for his innocence and stand by him. Theirs is a powerful display of unity, and their message is clear. Bundy is a good man. These protests are not lost on the Utah police. They understand that Bundy looks nothing like a typical criminal. With his charming smile and easy manner, his neatly pressed suit, and of course his status as a budding lawyer, it's hard to imagine him committing any sort of crime. Bundy himself supports this narrative. He smiles and waves for cameras and greets journalists with a wink. Time and again, he repeats that he's innocent and has nothing to worry about, adding that he has faith in the justice system. But then again, Carol DeRanch is certain he's the man who abducted her, and police can't forget the strange objects they found in his car. Ted Bundy and many of the Utah community seem convinced of his innocence. Police and DeRanch are certain of his guilt. It will now be down to a judge and jury to decide. It's March 1st, 1976. Inside a large courthouse in Salt Lake City, the trial of Ted Bundy is coming to a close. Bundy's been charged with the attempted kidnap of Carol DeRanch, a crime to which he has pleaded innocent. But it's been a strange trial. Bundy surprised everyone when he waived his right to a jury and asked to be tried only by a judge. It's not clear why he took this option, but many speculate he's so confident of his innocence that he believes there's no point troubling a jury. Over the past week, Bundy's charmed the courtroom. He's shared jokes, told stories, waved and smiled at spectators. He's nothing like the deranged-looking killers America's known before, individuals such as Charles Manson. While Bundy's been defending his innocence, Carol DeRanch has been swearing his guilt. When she took the stand, she told the court about her abduction, how Bundy approached her in the mall and attacked her in his car. Over hours of grueling cross-examination, DeRanch never faltered once in her accusation that Bundy is guilty. Today, the judge will decide. As the midday sun rises over Salt Lake City, casting shadows across the courtroom, the judge returns his verdict. Ted Bundy is found guilty of the attempted kidnap of Carol DeRanch. He receives a sentence of 1 to 15 years inside a Utah state prison. Although this should be a crushing blow for 29-year-old Bundy, his face doesn't show disappointment or anger. Instead, he maintains the relaxed demeanor he's shown throughout trial and flashes a smile as he's escorted from the courtroom. However, although Bundy might believe he can fight this charge and prove his innocence, he has no idea what's coming next. Unbeknown to him, while he's been in custody and on trial, police in Colorado have been busy doing some digging into the recent abductions in their state. And what they've found has the potential to lock Bundy up for life. While investigating the Colorado disappearances, authorities discovered two key details which could finally link Bundy to the killings. First, they recovered the body of a woman called Karen Campbell, a 23-year-old who disappeared from her hotel in Colorado in January 1975. Strangulation marks and a fractured skull indicate Campbell was murdered. Second, they found a ski map of the area Karen Campbell was staying in, as well as a brochure for her hotel inside Ted Bundy's apartment. This directly links Bundy to her disappearance and subsequent murder. When Colorado police reveal their findings to the FBI, they agree that it warrants his arrest. So in early 1977, under a year since he was convicted of kidnap, Bundy is charged with first-degree murder and extradited to a jail in Aspen. While he waits behind bars, Colorado authorities set about finding proof that he's the infamous serial killer. At this moment in time, 3 years since the disappearances first began in Washington, the evidence against Bundy is strong. Police are certain of his guilt, as are many members of the public. But did Bundy really commit all of these heinous crimes? 5 murders and countless suspected murders, as well as an attempted kidnap, which have taken place at a whirlwind pace within the last 2 years. How is it possible that this man is guilty? He's a law student and psychology graduate who dresses in smart suits, charms everyone he meets, and seems, by all accounts, to be perfectly normal. If he really is behind the attacks, then he's a new type of killer, one which America has never before seen, and one whose unknowability makes him the most dangerous person on the planet. As Bundy is locked up in Aspen jail facing charges for first-degree murder, all of America holds its breath nervously to find out who this man really is. Little do they know that they'll have to wait over a decade for the answers, and when they're revealed, it will be in one of history's most infamous deathbed confessions. Next week on Deathbed Confessions. The Ted Bundy story continues. During Bundy's murder trial, it becomes clear that he's unlike any criminal America's ever known. He's determined to defend himself and avoid justice, no matter what the price. Bundy's trial is one of national intrigue, fascination, obsession, and the interest in his case will continue long after the jury's filed its verdict. Years later, Bundy will make a series of chilling confessions hours before his death. With his dying words, he'll reveal horrific answers to questions America has been asking for decades. Who really is Ted Bundy? What crimes is he guilty of? And how many women did he kill? Find out next week on Deathbed Confessions. Deathbed Confessions is a Spotify original from Parcast, produced in partnership with Noiser. Executive produced by Max Cutler, Drew Cole, and Pascal Hughes. Developed by Julian Boireau for Parcast. Series produced by Addison Nugent. Associate producer Nicole Edmonds. Written by Nicole Edmonds. Supervising editor Jane O. Sound supervisor Tom Pink. Sound design by Cody Reynolds Shaw. Edited by Carla Flores and Rob Plummer. Mix master by Cody Reynolds Shaw. Music by Oliver Baines and Dory McCauley.